This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Today's show was pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take your questions and comments. Coming up later in the show, we'll learn about the 30-year relationship between First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt and Associated Press reporter Lorena Hickok, and we'll hear about the caterpillar that brainwashed the wasp. First, in his latest book, former Washington Post East Asia Bureau Chief Blaine Harden tells the story of a rogue American spy who operated during the Korean War. Virtually unsupervised by the U.S. military, Air Force Major Donald Nichols planned and ran covert missions on the Korean Peninsula for 11 years. He ended up being taken out of Korea in a straitjacket by American military authorities. I recently spoke with Blaine Harden about his new book, King of Spies, The Dark Reign of an American Spy Master in Korea. Blaine, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure.
So, how did you first hear of Donald Nichols?
I first heard about him from a North Korean fighter pilot. He escaped from North Korea in 1953 in a MiG, and he landed the MiG at a U.S. Air Force base near Seoul, jumped out of his plane, said, "Take me to your leader." And the leader they took him to was Donald Nichols, who was the number one Air Force spy in the Korean Peninsula. The pilot was astonished because Nichols spoke Korean. He drank Coca-Cola by the case, almost a case a day. He was very fat. He ate chocolate bars. And he knew almost everything about the inner workings of the North Korean Air Force and the inner workings of the North Korean government. Nichols had sources throughout the North Korean government during the war.
So that freaks out this pilot. He's thinking, how does this guy know as much about North Korea as I do?
Exactly. And it also, for me, I'd never heard of Donald Nichols. You know, at that point, I'd done two books on Korea and had been reporting about it for about a decade. And so I wondered, who is this guy? Where did he come from? What did he do in the Korean War? And what happened to him? Why is he lost to history? And so then I spent the past 3 years getting documents, including his military service record and lots of previously classified documents from the National Archives and the Air Force Archives. I also talked to all his relatives and the people he fought with who were serving for the U.S. Air Force and for the South Korean intelligence services.
So, Blaine, what surprises you most as you're doing all this research?
Well, I guess what surprised me most is that Nichols basically was an island unto himself. He reported uniquely in the Air Force to a general. He started this off, he was a sergeant, and he's promoted to lieutenant and then captain, but he only reported to the general, a man named Earl Partridge, who ran the 5th Air Force, which was basically running the Korean War. So he had nobody to tell him what to do, because the general was, you know, quite busy running a war. So Nichols was given a free rein to build his own base, his own secret base. He had his own secret army of about 1,000 men, U.S. officers, South Korean officers, and 700 to 800 agents that Nichols would send constantly into North Korea, most of whom were killed when they arrived. But Nichols kept this up for 11 years, all in secret. His name never appeared in the New York Times or the Washington Post throughout his career or afterwards.
How was he able to operate and maintain this anonymity to be a virtual unknown outside of Korea? How did that happen?
Well, he kept a low profile. He was sort of a social pygmy. He didn't like to chat at cocktail parties. He had a 7th grade education. That's one of the reasons. He just didn't hang out with reporters like some intelligence people do now in Washington. So that was one thing. Another thing was that the reporters were very much restricted in what they could write and what they could learn. And there was, in some ways, Nichols was lucky that he was not publicized. And then, most importantly, his career, he was basically erased by the U.S. Air Force. After he'd served for 11 years, his career was suddenly ended when the Air Force came for him, put him in a straitjacket, and took him to a psychiatric hospital at a military base in Japan, even though he was not mentally ill. Then they took him to another hospital in the Florida Panhandle in the fall of 1957, and they gave him more than 50 rounds of electroshock. He said to his relatives that the Air Force was trying to destroy his memory of what he'd done in the war. In any case, they gave him the electroshock and threw him out, and he became a non-person. A historian of U.S. Air Force Special Forces says Nichols was the kind of guy who had a dark side. You want him on your team in time of war. In time of peace, you lock him up. And he was locked up in a psychiatric hospital for a few months, and then he was pushed out into civilian life, where he wandered around, as he described it, as a kind of living dead man, a zombie, until he died in 1992.
But his superiors all this time that he was working as a spy, they praise him. He gets good reviews. He's highly effective. What was this dark side? What led to him being treated like this at the end?
One of the reasons he became uniquely powerful was he developed a close personal relationship with Syngman Rhee. Syngman Rhee was the president of South Korea. He was supposedly an American puppet leader in a state that the United States had actually created on the Korean Peninsula. But Syngman Rhee was a most obstreperous and difficult puppet. Besides fighting against North Korea in the Korean War, he fought against his political enemies in the South in a long, very bloody civil war. Nichols got involved in that civil war as one of the close associates of Syngman Rhee. And so Nichols ended up living in this demimonde of mass killings, torture, and severed heads. In my research, I found a U.S. Army photograph of Nichols on the roof of the South Korean Army headquarters in Seoul, standing next to a severed head in a bucket.
Mm. I want to go back a little bit because I'm still trying to grasp this, how somebody who was a middle school dropout who was working as, I think he was a mechanic, wasn't he, working on Jeeps at one of the bases?
Yeah, he fixed carburetors during World War II in Karachi.
How does he end up becoming a master spy like this?
Well, part of it is that he filled a vacuum. In 1946, when he arrived on the Korean Peninsula, no American military person wanted to be in Korea. They much preferred to be in Japan, where it was more comfortable. Korea was considered to be kind of a hellhole. So Nichols had enormous room to operate and virtually no supervision. And he was ambitious, wildly ambitious. He learned Korean. He developed this network of sources that allowed him to know what was going on in the North and the South. And by becoming Syngman Rhee's son, he could, and he strutted his influence inside the South Korean intelligence apparatus and the American intelligence apparatus. So he was powerful, and he made everyone aware that he was powerful, which only was a sort of a positive accelerator on his authority. So he quietly rose to this position of immense influence, and then the war broke out. And when the war broke out, it shocked the United States. Harry Truman was alarmed. He was really angry that his intelligence people had not told him that war was coming. He had not seen the reports, the many hundreds of reports that Nichols had written saying that war was coming. So Nichols then, with the invasion having started, he was in the catbird seat. The U.S. Air Force turned to him immediately and gave him virtually unlimited power. He started giving the Air Force bomb targets within a week of the invasion. And he continued to be the primary source of bomb targets throughout the war.
What was his training to become a spy?
6 weeks in a spy school in Tokyo. That was it. He, later in his life, he wrote a very unreliable and very strange memoir. But in that memoir, he said, you know, how did I, an uneducated, untrained guy, know the things that I knew? And there really is no answer to that. He was ambitious. He was shrewd. He was aggressive. He filled a vacuum. And once he got power, he used it.
You were talking about all the reports that Nichols created about the upcoming invasion. He pretty accurately called that, didn't he? That it was going to be the Russians, the Chinese, and the North Koreans swooping over the 38th parallel. He got that correct, didn't he?
He did. And it was part of a story of one of the gross intelligence failures in American history. Nichols was one of several intelligence officials who were working in Seoul who determined that North Korea was preparing to invade. Some of Nichols' reports actually found their way to the Joint Chiefs in Washington and were reviewed in the State Department. And it bounced back a question to the chief of intelligence then for the Far East, who was Charles Willoughby, who worked for Douglas MacArthur, the famous general. And so the Pentagon and the State Department asked Willoughby, are these reports true? Is North Korea preparing to invade? And in fact, they were. But what Charles Willoughby said is that, no, they're not preparing to invade. And what Willoughby then did, and which I found out, is he tried to have Nichols fired and thrown out of the Korean Peninsula. He failed in that. And after the invasion, Willoughby lost his job and spent much of the rest of his life accounting for why he had missed the signals of this war coming.
And didn't General Douglas MacArthur also want Nichols out of Korea as well?
I know that Charles Willoughby wanted him out. And Willoughby was an expert at telling MacArthur what he wanted to hear. So I'm not sure that Willoughby told MacArthur about Nichols. But I am quite sure that Willoughby tried to get Nichols fired, because I've seen the documents.
You talked about Nichols had basically his own private army. Now, what was that, Nick? Was that the name for it?
Yeah. As the war unwound, there were three major intelligence operations going on in Korea. There was the CIA, which had been created in the late 40s, which was still expanding and gaining strength, power, bureaucratically in Washington and with boots on the ground in Korea. There was Army Intelligence, which was by far the largest operation. And then there was NICC, which was an outfit that Nichols himself created and that he ran. And it was uniquely influential because NICC had these contacts with the South Korean president. So he was preeminent.
And did Nichols ever have any regrets? I mean, here he's asking these other agents to go on some very dangerous missions. And as I understand it, it became increasingly more and more dangerous to penetrate North Korea itself because the North Koreans were starting to catch on that this was happening and they were starting to put up more security and it was just becoming more of a danger to go there. Did he ever have any regrets about asking men to go into this situation?
Yes. In the memoir he wrote in the 1980s, which was filled full of misinformation, but was also contained some of his genuine thoughts about his service. He regretted the loss of life that was associated with his service. And he said that if he had had more training, a better education, he might have been a more ethical, law-abiding officer. He said in his memoir that he had a legal license to murder. And I know from talking to eyewitnesses that he exercised it. He sent people to their death in North Korea. He dropped people out of airplanes. He pushed them out of boats.
Wow.
To their death. But he regretted it, but still, he didn't examine it and explain it in any depth. That was left to my reporting once I got his military service record and found the people he'd served with.
So what do you think is the value of bringing out this story, telling this rather obscure story about Donald Nichols?
Well, I think the value of it for Americans right now is, you know, why is North Korea so angry with the United States that they're threatening to hit us with nuclear-tipped missiles? Where did this come from? What's the source of the anger? What role did America play in the creation of a divided Korean Peninsula? It's an academic question. It's obscure history. But what's great about the Nichols story is that it's a spy story. It's a thriller. It's a kind of Tony Soprano goes to Korea, wins a lot of medals, kicks the North Koreans' butt, and then is destroyed when he becomes Colonel Kurtz by his own Air Force. That's sort of a Cliff Notes version of the book. But what it does is it opens up the history and makes it palatable, exciting to read. And once you read it, you have a much better and more sophisticated understanding of the current crisis.
Yeah, and does it also explain how the Kim family has continued with this anti-American sentiment for so many decades, that they're going back to stories of what happened during the Korean War and using that to fuel this anti-American sentiment in their country?
That's right. They've taken a fact-based narrative, the American carpet bombing of North Korea, and they've perpetuated it over half a century to their own benefit. It justifies repression without end. They have a fact-based story to tell, but, you know, a lot of countries go to war and then they forget their war and move on, like the government of Vietnam, for example, has moved on. Almost all of the combatants from great conflicts, you know, they adapt to reality. But for the Kim family to survive, it needs to keep their population living in the 1950s. It needs to keep that same sense of terror alive because it justifies repression.
Blaine, is there a follow-up to this book or any place else to go with this story?
Well, you know, Nichols died, but the arc of his life really sort of opens up the history of the Korean War, and that's why I think it's really useful. And also, it's interesting to know what the U.S. Air Force would do to its own hero, which is to quietly destroy him.
Blaine, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Blaine Harden on his latest book, King of Spies, The Dark Reign of an American Spymaster in Korea. Coming up, we'll hear about the friendship and love affair between Eleanor Roosevelt and AP reporter Lorena Hickok. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.